what your country can do for you.
You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Government is not the solution to our problem.
Constitute an axis of evil.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday morning at 9, which means it's All Things Political. And we have a two-part All Things Political this morning. We'll begin with national news, and Clarence Page will be our guest. We'll talk about the fiscal cliff, fiscal slope, or an austerity bomb, whatever you want to call it. The scheduled budget cuts and tax increases that arrive on January 1st are the focus of Washington right now. We'll talk about that. The Supreme Court has decided to take up two same-sex marriage cases. The significance of that, is this the civil rights issue of our time? And why has the Supreme Court decided to take up this now? Immigration, Clarence Page has written about Lincoln, the movie, Susan Rice, and many more issues on our plate with Clarence Thomas, the first hour, or Clarence Page, Clarence Thomas, I'm thinking Supreme Court, Clarence Page, the first hour of our program. He, of course, is a syndicated columnist. He is with the Chicago Tribune and has been writing for many years about national issues. The second part of the hour will move from Washington to Wisconsin, where Governor Walker has created small but significant space between himself and a couple of policies advocated by members of the incoming Republican majority in the state legislature. We'll be looking at same-day voter registration, the number of jobs that have been created, and a number of other issues with Dave Zweifel of the Capital Times. Both segments, you are ever so welcome to join this conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Clarence Page, hello.
Good morning. How are you, Kathleen?
I'm good. It's good to talk to you, always.
You too.
Always. Well, let's start with, we'll get into the fiscal cliff, but let's start with why the Supreme Court decided now to take up two same-sex marriage cases.
The Supreme Court apparently, and we've always got to say apparently, they are tight as a drum over there. But this is a big surprise because people on both sides were expecting them to possibly kick this can down the road again. But the fact that they are agreeing to review it now indicates that they see the public needs this, that the pressure is on the and I tell you, you know, I've been supportive of this effort since its early days, and also thought that it didn't have much of a prayer of getting anywhere in my lifetime. And that, I mean, same-sex marriage and don't ask, don't tell in the military. And yet we've seen in recent years, suddenly this horse has just picked up a gallop, rolling from state to state, first with court decisions and then popular referendum. And a lot of it's generational, you know. A younger generation is moving up in the military and civilian life. And I think the Supreme Court recognizes that and has decided to take a position on that could very well be defining for the entire gay marriage issue here in the U.S.
And when you say defining, what would a defining rule be, Clarence?
Well, it would have to look at things like, obviously, it's okay now for states to do what they want to do, but other states don't have to recognize what that state does. The federal government, that's what DOMA is about. Of course, the Defense of Marriage Act is a federal law that was passed to prevent the idea or the, well, first of all, federal programs don't have to recognize same-sex marriage or domestic partners if they don't want to. That includes Social Security as well as health care coverage or pensions of public employees. The various states don't have to recognize. You know, Illinois or Wisconsin doesn't have to recognize a marriage that takes place in Vermont or the mm-hmm. District of Columbia. So the civil rights issue here is there a right for people to have their same-sex marriage recognized? Is it a fundamental right enough that no single state can deny it? And that's why a lot of people call this a civil rights issue of our times, because it because that part of it parallels the debate over civil rights that took place in the 50s and 60s.
Let's move to that fiscal cliff slope or austerity bomb, whatever we're going to call it.
I call it the fiscal bluff, but that's just me.
Well, that's let's add that to our list, Clarence. The
right.
Fiscal bluff. The president and Speaker Boehner met last night. Do you know what they talked about? Are they getting close to an increase in tax rate for the rich?
Well, we can read the handwriting on the walls that they won't let us see. the fact that, you know, they met, that's number one. That's important because day after day we've been hearing both sides say there's no progress, and we could see they weren't talking to each other, but they've been talking up a storm to the public on both sides to persuade us that their side is right. The fact that they did both meet yesterday and they came out giving almost word for word the same statement, you know, yes, we met today and we'll meet again, sort of thing, and which shows some coordination. And I think, though, you know, let's remember back that Boehner and President Obama months ago had a grand bargain that they worked very hard to hammer out, and then it was rejected largely by the right-wing Republicans, the Tea Party Republicans in Congress, and that was just shelved until after the election. Now we now see both the fact that President Obama did get reelected in spite of the wishes of the Tea Party, and we have a deadline. We have this fiscal cliff, as it's called, at the end of the year, where you have across the board cuts in spending and the restoration of the Bush tax cuts if the Congress and the president don't take any action at all. And this has international markets as well as domestic jittery over the possibility of another recession. When you pull that much money out of the economy, you've got the makings of another recession. So I've been saying for a while here that, well, both sides want to solve this thing, but it requires pain, you know. And the way Congress works traditionally, if they've got something nice to offer the public, they get it out right away. If they have something that involves pain, and this involves pain for everybody across the board, they wait till the very last minute and may even go over the fiscal cliff if it means that Republicans can then negotiate back and restore some of those Bush tax cuts for everybody but the rich, say, then they can go back to their constituents and say, hey, I tried really hard, but, you know, we at least got the restoration of a tax cut for you, you middle-income voters. And that is a possibility, but I think everybody wants to avoid that now, because just the mere act of going over the cliff is just one more blow to the United States' reputation as a fiscally sound and responsible and stable country. So I think that's what we're seeing now. And now, you know, they've only got a couple of weeks really to hammer something together. So I think this is a good sign that that we see Speaker Boehner and President Obama meeting together.
We haven't had a chance to speak since the election. The Democrats won. The Republicans are examining their future. You have entertained the question of what it is they have to do in order to win more elections. What changes do they need to make, the Republican Party?
Well, they you know, the pendulum swings back and forth in this country politically. I think Republicans need to do what Democrats did back in the 80s after they'd suffered one defeat after another, including the George McGovern and the 1984 Reagan versus Mondale elections, where almost every state went with the Republicans, and you had the Reagan Revolution. Democrats got together, moderate Democrats got together and formed think tanks and organizations and new agendas that were center left, and that's where you saw Bill Clinton and Al Gore and other voices like theirs rise up, and yeah, the beginnings of the kind of a Democratic Party that you have today. And Barack Obama obviously comes right out of that center left tradition, Regardless of all the talk about he's a socialist and everything else you hear, realistically, he's center left. A lot of people on the left look at Tavis Smiley and Cornel West, among others, who are very displeased that he's not farther left. But Republicans now, they've swung so far to the right that they, as we saw with the election turnout, they won older white males and married white women. Those are about the only two constituencies where they got a majority. And they were trounced, and particularly Hispanic voters are very important here, because if Mitt Romney had gotten the same turnout that George W. Bush got in 2004 among Hispanics, we'd be calling him President-elect Romney right now.
Right.
Instead, he and his party alienated Hispanics, among other groups, women voters, especially single women, reacted at the polls. We can see that the party needs to talk about itself and its future. The party establishment, the Republican establishment, has just been almost invisible in recent years. And I'd say ever since like the 2006 midterms, after a string of Republican congressional scandals. We saw the rise of the Tea Party in 2010, and they've really been holding sway. Now, Speaker Boehner just unseated four stubborn Republican chairmen, if you will, who were not voting with his view, the moderate establishment view. We saw Jim DeMint over in the Senate left last week, and this was a surprise, to go to the Conservative Heritage Foundation. He apparently thinks that he sees the handwriting on the wall, that he's done about all he can do as the big Tea Party voice in the Senate. We're seeing people like Chris Christie, I think, is indicative of the establishment voice being heard again. Yeah, right wingers were very upset that he was so complimentary of President Obama and the response to Hurricane Sandy. But I think Chris Christie's stock among swing voters just shot up. We could see the other Bush brother, Jeb Bush, the older Bush brother, is rising as a potential candidate for 2016. And this is, I think, indicative of the moderate Republican establishment reasserting itself, which I expected would happen, and I'm not the only one. And it takes about one or two election cycles for the populist movements like the Tea Party movement to rise. And what was H.L. Mencken said? Populist movements are like bees. They sting and then they die.
Clarence Page, our guest for the first part of All Things Political. We'll go to state news the second half hour of the show with Dave Zwiefel, who's editor emeritus for the Capital Times. We're looking at a number of issues with Clarence, the fiscal cliff or whatever you want to call it. We're looking at the Supreme Court's amazing decision to take up gay marriage, two important cases. Clarence also, I'm so glad he did this, wrote an article about the Lincoln movie in which he had some interesting things to say, how far would the 13th Amendment have gotten in today's age of Twitter and cable TV news talk shows. We'll ask him that. But mostly we want at this point to entertain your questions. Our time is limited with him, so I would strongly suggest you call in right now. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Leave a message for us on our Facebook page if you would like to do that, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Clarence Page, our guest this part of the show, op-ed columnist, syndicated columnist for Tribune Media Services, member of the editorial board for the Tribune, and man about television as an analyst. Let's go to Tim in Madison. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Tim in Madison, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Clarence.
Good morning.
I've heard in some discussions on NPR and other radio stations that it is in Obama's interest to actually go over the fiscal cliff, or rather the Democratic interest to go over the cliff, because Obama can completely blame it on the Republicans and also achieve the same kind of cuts and the same kind of deductions of spending that he's been seeking. So is that really true? And if Clarence can provide an analysis of that, that's why Obama is bargaining so hard. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, thank you for your question. Yes, it is true to a degree. First of all, polling shows that the public in general is blaming the current standoff on the Republicans in much the same way that Newt Gingrich and Republican members of Congress took the most of the public's blame in the standoff with Bill Clinton that resulted in back-to-back government shutdowns in the 90s. Secondly, the reason why we have this so-called fiscal cliff is because of the agreement that was made to end the debt ceiling crisis. It's sort of one of these the kind of agreement was set that what was called sequestration, one of my most hated words in that language, but the sequestration agreement was that if they didn't come to a deal on the fiscal on the Bush tax cuts and the other deficit problems by the first of 2013, then there would be across the board cuts. And the idea was that both the right and the left, you've got the restoration of the Bush tax cuts, which we know are going to be automatic anyway under law. You've got the big cuts in defense spending and other across the board, except for Social Security and Medicare. They set them aside so they wouldn't be touched by this crisis, but everything else is just about. And you've got a bunch of other tax hikes that would set in the automatic minimum tax and breaks that President Obama put in the payroll taxes in order to help stimulate the economy with middle-class taxpayers. All of this would happen. So it wouldn't be popular. Everybody would take a hit one way or another. President Obama knows that, so he is not likely to be totally cavalier about this. But basically, yeah, the two big items, I would say, you know, the restoration of the Bush tax cuts, the end of the Bush tax cuts, and the defense spending cuts, those are both things Democrats want and things that Republicans don't want. So in that sense, if Obama does nothing, then Democrats get two big items that they want, among others. And that's one reason why people say that President Obama has the upper hand in these negotiations. It is promising that President Obama and Speaker Boehner met together yesterday. Shows that they want to avoid going over the cliff, I think. I think there's a pretty good chance that they will.
I'm so glad you wrote about Abraham Lincoln and the movie fairly recently.
Somebody had to, right?
I'm glad you did. I love Abraham Lincoln. He's so interesting to me. So how do you answer this question, Clarence? How far would the 13th Amendment have gotten in today's age of Twitter and cable TV news shows?
Well, it certainly wouldn't have gotten very far the way that Lincoln did it. That's what's so fascinating about this movie. It's so seldom that you have a movie that really takes a realistic look at how laws get made. And it is like what Otto von Bismarck said, anybody who loves the law and loves sausage should never watch either of them being made. And, boy, this movie, you really see it. I mean, President Obama is what Fox News would call a Chicago-style politician. To get the votes he needed to get that amendment passed, all kinds of skullduggery went on behind the scenes, virtually out-and-out bribery. And one of those, you know, what's your definition of is, in order to convince the Republicans, I got to get this straight now. In those days, Republicans were the progressive voice.
Right, right.
With the Democrats, the Southern Democrats in particular, but not just in the South, who wanted to keep slavery going. In any case, you know, he virtually lies about the fact that there's some peace talks going on, because that would take the pressure off to pass this amendment and all. It was the kind of an age in which, of course, without media except for the telegraph, you were able to do a lot of things you wouldn't be able to do today. But that doesn't mean that you still wouldn't be able to use all kinds of means to get one vote after another. It's just you would have to do it differently. And I wanted to convey the idea that today's media, much as I love them, it's my life work, that people can be fooled into getting caught up in the day-to-day shenanigans of legislating and miss the bigger picture, like something like ending slavery. As moral as that
right.
You know, it required in our system some skullduggery at the margins in order to get that passed.
Yeah.
And so we can't be absolutists about the day-to-day operations of government.
Terry and Baraboo, hi.
Yeah, how you doing?
All right, Terry.
Thanks for taking my call. I was just wanted to ask if Clarence agrees that there are certain parts of this fiscal cliff that both parties do agree on. And I was just wondering if you felt that they can agree on those issues and then deal with this, the 2% tax increase later on.
Yeah, they, I would say yes, there are. And but just like every other major confrontation in Washington, the parts that they agree on aren't the problem. The parts they don't agree on. And taxes are a defining issue for Republicans. As my buddy Tucker Carlson says, what's the fun of being a Republican if you can't cut taxes? And for Democrats, the protecting the middle class is a defining issue. And so you know, what Republicans would call class warfare. So that's what's really getting hung up here. And I think they're going to find a way to work this out. I mean, the answer is sitting right in front of them, but it's political
right.
considerations, taking care of your constituents and the lobbyists, et cetera, that's holding things up.
Thank you, Terry. Marty in Douglas County. Hi.
Good morning. Kathleen, is this right? You're such a Lincoln scholar. Did Lincoln once say, your argument is as thin as a broth made from a pigeon that died of starvation? I heard that somewhere. I'm wondering, what's the conventional wisdom following the great win by the Democrats this year, the vote in Michigan, the right to bust unions, also known as the right to work, vote over there. And what's with the Tea Party? Are they waning? Are they still strong?
Well, I think that, as I mentioned earlier, the Tea Party is on the wane. But, you know, let's go back through history to all the populist movements of the past. They all had an impact on the mainstream, whether they came from the right or from the left. And the Tea Party obviously has had a big influence. The Tea Party, in my view, right now is the right wing of the Republican Party. They are indistinguishable. Let's just face up to it. They have energized the party in that way, but it's up to the party establishment to really lead. And so that's their conflict. And the other thing, you know, at the state level, the Michigan right to work debate, like the Wisconsin argument over the budget and unions, and we could say Illinois, I mean, just about every other state in the union except for Texas and North Dakota because of oil, almost all of our states are broke to one degree or another, and some hard decisions have to be made. And the activists, I'd say, tend to be on the right at the state level. The Tea Party folks have a lot more clout there, just as they have more clout in midterm elections nationally. And so that's my general nutshell interpretation of what's happening in Michigan. And in Michigan, if unions fail there, I mean, is there any state that where has more of a stronger union tradition than Michigan, except maybe Illinois? It's really, I think it's a sign of our times.
Thanks, Marty. One more call. Scott in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Good morning. My question, I guess, comment has to do with, let me start with, I've got no problem with tax increases. I mean, the top 2% going up, that's fine. I don't have an issue with it. But I really want somebody to have some perspective, because it's about $75 billion a year over 10 years when we're running a $1.2 trillion deficit. So it's very small. I mean, it's almost an accounting error is what it is. My question is, throughout the campaign, we have, and we continue to hear from Democrats how great the Clinton years were, and in relation to Clinton tax rates. So shouldn't all those rates go up? If you're going to correlate, which the Democrats do, successful economy with higher taxes, and that was a correlation throughout the campaign, why not let all the tax rates go up? Because let's be honest here, the largest amount of revenue coming to the Treasury is going to be from all those other tax increases. That little 2%, which the president talks about more than any other metric, which is kind of strange in itself because it's going to have such a small impact on our financial mess. Shouldn't we just let all of the rates go up?
Well, that's the debate. Democrats would be delighted to let all the rates return to the Clinton levels. And with Republicans, so this is, as I say, a core philosophical issue. And it is philosophical. And you look at the large number, for example, of Christian evangelicals in the Tea Party movement. Polls show between 50 and 60% of Tea Party folks are Christian evangelical. And they are in that tradition of Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, that views deficit spending as a sin, as a real mortal sin. And I've talked to Tea Party folks who have expressed it this way. So we're talking about a real gut issue with a lot of folks, and that's the hang-up there. Also, mathematics. People, the average citizen on the street, I've been astounded by the different ways that people have interpreted what the numbers are here. They don't distinguish marginal tax rate from a general tax rate like, for example, you know, we're talking about, like, you know, when President Obama's talking about raising taxes on every dollar you make after $250,000. But a lot of other folks think that when they talk about raising the rate, that means the rate on all the money you make. I mean, there's a lot of confusion like this among various voters, and I think that has been a hang-up, too. We've been in an education process here for the last couple of years, public education process, for people to really know the numbers as well as the caller does there.
Clarence, always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you, sir, and happy holidays.
You too. Thank you, and the best to you and to your listeners.
Thanks, Clarence. Clarence Page, op-ed columnist, syndicated columnist for Tribune Media Services, member of the editorial board for the Chicago Tribune, and analyst, political analyst on many national television shows. We switch to state politics, the second part of the program. There's a lot going on, of course, in the state, and we're delighted to have Dave Zweifel as our guest now. He is editor emeritus of the Capital Times. He served with the paper since he graduated from UW-Madison in 1962, and was the paper's editor from 1983 to 2008. He writes frequently in a Plain Talk column, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him as well. We'll be looking at jobs in the state. We'll talk about voter registration. We'll talk about education and a number of other issues. 800-486-8655 remains our number. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hi, Dave. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thank you.
Yeah, great pleasure. Let's start with what you say is, let's quote from your column on November 21st. In your book, there's nothing more despicable than politicians who spend their time devising ways to make it harder for people to vote, and Governor Scott Walker is at the top of the list. Do you think that he wants to proceed with this no more same-day registration, or is he backing away from it?
Well, I think that personally he's backing away from it because there was an incredible backlash to his comments that he made, of course, in California. But I don't think some of the legislators are backing away from it. And Clefish from the Watertown area, for example, has made it clear that he is going to introduce a bill. And once the bill gets introduced, it's on its way. And I think, sort of like we've been seeing in Michigan, the governor may not necessarily be proactive in pushing that kind of legislation, whether it's right to work or whether it's voter ID or doing away with same-day registration. But the governors like Snyder in Michigan and Walker here in Wisconsin are pretty clear that if a bill like that comes to their desk, they'll sign it. And so it's a matter of, I think, time. We'll see this legislation come through the next year.
And as you mentioned, we've had this for 36 years in the state of Wisconsin. I would imagine there's going to be a bit of hullabaloo about this issue as it moves closer to becoming a reality, if it does.
Yeah, I think so. I guess one of the questions is how many Republican legislators will actually oppose doing away with same-day registration. I think there is some glimmer of hope there. I'm old enough, I guess I remember when it was enacted during the Pat Lucey era, and same-day registration was hailed as a way to really increase citizen involvement in our electoral process and to get young people in particular to vote. I think one of the big problems in vote totals before same-day registration was that college kids who could now vote at age 18, they move so often that they their registrations were very difficult to do in advance. And if you could prove that you lived in a place for 30 days and had identification to show that was your address, whether it was a utility bill or whatever, you could vote. And I think you know, the whole tenet of our democracy is to get citizen involvement, and the more people that take part, the better for all of us. And I just find it deplorable that that some in public office today would like that to be less of a factor than it should otherwise be.
Dave, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the Milwaukee County John Doe investigation. You wrote recently that it appears that Governor Walker will escape prosecution. Why do you say that?
Well, because it doesn't appear that there is anyone that is fingering the governor himself. I don't think that they have anybody that is implicating Walker directly, whether it be a code of silence or whether actually there isn't anything there. I just don't think it's going to go any further than it has now.
Do you want to comment on any of the recent sentencings or what's coming up?
Yeah, it's really the governor likes to wash his hands of this whole thing. And, you know, while he was county executive in Milwaukee, he surrounded himself with people who did the despicable things and not necessarily just campaigning on taxpayers' dime, but taking money from veterans groups and, you know, misrepresenting what fundraisers and were going to. And it's, you know, there's always irresponsible when you're in charge. And whether if when I was editor of the paper, if one of my reporters was guilty of an ethical lapse or whether we did something wrong in the paper, the finger was always pointed at me as the editor, and as well it should have. And I think that a county executive who surrounds himself with people who are actually breaking the law has to take responsibility for that.
Mm-hmm. The story that broke over the weekend, this possible pay to play. Story, is that going to develop into anything or something?
I don't know. I have to admit I was out of town over the weekend, but I understand the Einhorns, the Einhorn family, were major contributors to Walker's campaigns. Got a state contract worth quite a bit of money, and it certainly is. His appearances are certainly suspect, and it need to be, taken. We need to take a good look at that. Whether it develops into a major issue is yet to be determined.
Maybe not on the scale of huge importance, but people are talking about this issue. I know, and I'm sure you've heard conversation too. Why would the remodeling of the kitchen in the governor's mansion cost $400,000, almost $500,000? I mean, seriously, this is an issue we can all rally around.
That's right. I know kitchen remodeling is very expensive. My wife did that about 10 years ago, and it cost a lot more money than I thought it was going to cost. But it was like $50,000. But $450,000 or $500,000 is an incredible amount of money to remodel a kitchen, no matter how large it is. It's I imagine there are a lot of restaurants and that we all go to that have kitchens that are worth a heck of a lot less than that. But I find this extremely extravagant, and especially coming from an administration that insists that we don't have any money and that we have to that state workers and other public employees have to, have to share in the burden of this terrible outlook that we have, and turn around and spend $500,000 on a kitchen is pretty unreal.
You may as well just buy a whole new nice house, huh?
That's right.
yeah,
for sure. $500,000 homes are pretty nice.
Let's look at job creation in the state. The governor, of course, ran on this issue strongly and announced that he was going to create 250,000 jobs during his first administration. The reports are that 1/10 of those jobs have been created, and Republicans are saying that they wish there were more, but that we were in such an unsettled state in this state with the recall election, with what they say would be the future of health care reform in this country, that people didn't want to start businesses. Is there truth to that, that we were too unsettled to have job growth?
Well, I don't know if that's really the case. As someone once pointed out, that if businesses can make some money, they will expand. And if there's demand for their products, they will expand regardless of what the what's happening in the political world or even the economic world around them. It's it's sort of a mystery why we're having so much trouble increasing our jobs here in Wisconsin. But I don't think that the Walker plans have helped. I mean, we have given away a lot to the corporate interests and business interests in an effort to give them incentives to expand or to give them tax breaks to do certain things that are supposedly will create jobs. But it's not working, and it's given away a lot of state money at the expense of other things that I think we could be doing. It still sticks in my craw that one of the governor's first actions was to do away with the high-speed rail between Madison and Milwaukee, and an infrastructure investment that would have created a lot of jobs, at least for a couple years, and help move our state off the dime. And yet that was something that was politically dismissed, and in what I thought was an incredible grandstanding posture on the part of the governor. But and then we turn around and give a lot of tax breaks to ideas that I'm not sure are going to help. We are among the top states now in terms of giving corporate largesse in an effort to make our state seem more hospitable to businesses, but I don't see it working.
Dave Zwiefel is our guest, this part of All Things Political, editor emeritus for the Capital Times, and we're welcoming your phone calls. So here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and you can leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hour two of our program, we will be speaking with three of the members of the famed comedy group Second City. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your phone calls now for Dave, Tom in Middleton. Hi.
Good morning. I am going to ask Mr. Zwiefel how we as inspectors, I'm a chief inspector in Middleton, and how we can work with other election workers to prevent this bill from passing that would eliminate same-day registration? What can we do?
Well, I guess just make your voices heard as loudly as you can. I think we all need to stand up and proclaim, you know, how badly we think this is going to hurt voting in Wisconsin, particularly if you're an inspector. And I think your views on this will be even more important than the regular fellow on the street. I think if you band together and let your legislators know how you feel about this, that certainly can't hurt.
Is writing a better way, just handwritten letter, is that a better way than an email or a phone call?
I say they're all about equal. I think as long as your voice gets heard, as long as the email is read and the letter you've written is opened, perhaps one of the better ways is the phone call and try to get through actually to the legislator himself, him or herself, and voice your opinion. It's you know, the pushback. I think there, you know, the clerks in Wisconsin, the election clerks, the city and town clerks, you know, immediately made their voice heard when after Walker's initial announcement that he during that appearance he made in California, and that sort of pushed him back quite a bit. Now, if we can push back at the legislators themselves, maybe we have a chance that this innocuous bill will never be introduced.
Thank you, Tom, very much for the call. Randy in P. Wascom, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Basically, your guest just said, well, the goings-on in Madison really wouldn't shake up business. I'm a small business owner, and yes, it will shake up business when you don't know what the heck's going on, when you've got one group that's just basically trying to shut everything down so they can get whatever they want at the expense of business. Because basically, when you're talking organized labor, it's not a it's not a cooperation. It's like we want what we want, and if the business has to go out of business for us to get it, that's fine.
Oh, I don't think that's the case at all with labor unions. I think there's a lot of give and take between the workers and management that has to occur in order for everybody to share in the marketplace. You have to strike that happy medium. You can't just have a extremely pro-business all your laws and subsidies and whatever go strictly to businesses, and you forget about the working people, or vice versa. But there's certainly a happy medium there that we ought to all strive for.
Thanks very much for the call. Ellen in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Ellen.
Hello there. I'm just wondering, you know, I'm very progressive, and I'm so happy that President Obama, Tammy Baldwin, are now in place, but I'm very, very worried about the state houses. The Republicans have taken over 30 state houses, some of them completely, and especially here in the state of Wisconsin, it seems like the left has no voice whatsoever. And I'm afraid this is going to become the United States of Alec.
Does the left have a voice in Wisconsin, Dave?
Well, it's got a voice in certain parts of Wisconsin, for sure. But it is very difficult at the state level. This is a result, actually, of the 2010 elections, where the Republicans, particularly the Tea Party folks, really made a lot of inroads. And it was sort of a tenor of the times. And the left or the liberals or progressives got swept away during that tumultuous time. And that put the Republican Party in charge of redistricting in most states. And that's what's happened here in Wisconsin. I mean, the Democratic legislative candidates actually received more votes during this 2012 elections than the Republicans did. But yet, because of the way the districts have been configured, the Republicans were able to hang on to their seats and even add some in the Senate, of course. I think one of the big pushes that has to be made now in the years ahead is to take away redistricting from the politicians, because it really thwarts Democratic control. It thwarts our democracy, not Democratic with a small d. It allows districts that are not representative of the people who live in a particular area, but are bunched together in some ridiculous boundaries to achieve the results that the party in power wants to achieve.
And put it in the hands of who, Dave?
We need to put it in the hands of an independent commission or a commission of judges, like our Government Accountability Board, someone that we take it out of the partisan aura here, where politics supersedes everything in how we go about making democracy work.
Thanks, Ellen, for your call. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. What I'd like to talk about today is hypocrisy and congruence or lack of congruence, because we, on the one hand, ostensibly, the conservatives are committed to respect for life and also law and order, but it doesn't always manifest itself in terms of enforcement of the laws. Recently, 150 families, and the number may be growing, in Jackson have filed a suit against the pipeline company because of a rupture of a pipeline, which led to cancer-causing benzene being put in the drinking water for these people, and also, of course, the water that they use for showering. And apparently it took a week before the company even notified the people. And the people are asking for damages, including establishing establishment of a medical monitoring fund to provide early access to early cancer screening. And so it just seems to me that it's interesting to me that in Texas that we've got a football player being prosecuted for manslaughter because of his drunk driving, but in conservative Washington County and from our conservative state attorney general, we see no action to indict the pipeline people for some sort of manslaughter for their behavior.
Dave.
Yeah. Well, I can't argue with that assessment. I think that's it's right on. And yet we are in a time when our politicians are trying to make it harder and harder for citizens to get redress for carelessness that affects their lives and actually damages their lives. So it's you're absolutely right. Companies should not be left off the hook when they actually have done something that as a result of carelessness or unconcern for the environment around them.
Not fair to do this in 45 seconds, but I'll ask you anyway. You've written about your concerns over a makeover of the state's proud educational system. What are your major concerns?
Well, I just don't quite understand what's happening here in terms of turning the university system, for example, into sort of a direct pipeline for business interests. And if they don't graduate enough students that help fill the holes that businesses have, that they're going to get less aid. What does this do for liberal arts? For history scholars, the kind of things that our universities are so well known for, particularly UW-Madison, in turning out leaders of the country rather than maybe somebody who goes to work in one of our factories. I find that to be very troubling.
Dave, we're out of time on that note. I know there's more to be said, and we'll say it at some point. Dave, thank you so much
all
for
right.
being with us. Join
sure,
us again,
Kathleen.
Please.
Thank you.
Our guest this half of the show, Dave Zweifel. He is editor emeritus for the Capital Times. We also thank Clarence Page, syndicated columnist, for joining us the first part of the program. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program.